Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who is a senior fellow with the National Security Archives at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. He has taught at the University of Texas and at American University, and is the author of a number of books, including The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, America's Space Sentinels, DSP Satellites and National Security, The U.S. Intelligence Community, A Century of Spies, Intelligence in the 20th Century, and America's Secret Eyes in Space, the U.S. Keyhole Spy Satellite Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson.
Thank you.
And I understand that you made the Freedom of Information request to get these files declassified on Area 51. Were you surprised at what you got? Or did you get more than you expected, less than you expected?
Well, actually, more than I expected. I had filed this request in 2005. And there was an earlier version of this document that was released in 2002, and it was very, very heavily redacted. And the version that came through this time had far less in the way of redactions, and it had information not only on Area 51, but British participation in the U-2 program, the Chinese angle and the flights over China, surveillance of its French nuclear test site, and some new information on other aerial reconnaissance programs. So it was substantially more than I would have expected based on what the case had been last time.
And going back to the beginning of why this area was chosen, it's next to the Nevada test site, and this, we're talking about the 1950s. I take it that physically it is surrounded by ridges and it's in a deep valley. It's a dry salt lake, a Groom Lake. And so what led to the decision and how did it get such a mystique?
Well, what led to the decision was the need to find a place where the U-2 spy plane could be tested in secret. Such a plane had been proposed to President Eisenhower late in 1954 and approved because they were Eisenhower and others were very anxious to find some means of actually penetrating the veil of Soviet secrecy and finding out what was going on at bomber bases and possible missile facilities and naval facilities and atomic weapons related facilities in the Soviet Union, and obviously you couldn't tell simply from flying along the periphery. So they eventually approved the U-2, the program for develop a U-2, and they needed some place to test it, and they wanted some place to test it in deep secrecy because they obviously didn't want the Soviet Union to know anything about this plane. They were hoping it would fly over without even being noticed. And so this was a location that was located by Richard Bissell flying in the area and was selected as someplace where they could have this secret facility.
And how do they get people in and out of there? I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Well, they have air service. I mean, mm-hmm. You could go, today they will have people going to the airport in Las Vegas and they go on a plane and they land there, and then they reverse the process to go home.
So they commute to work by air shuttle.
Yes, it's a remote location, and it's not place where not some place where people are going to be driving to work.
And subsequent to the U-2 program, they tested and developed stealth aircraft there, didn't they?
This is a whole variety. The successor to the U-2, which was known as the Ox Carter, the A-12, was tested there, as was the Air Force variant of the A-12, which is the much better-known SR-71 Blackbird. And in addition to that, later on, the F-117 stealth fighter was tested there, as well as a very sort of strange-looking airplane that never actually became operational, known as Tacit Blue, was also tested in the area. In addition to that, MiG fighters that were obtained by one means or another that were flown there to allow the U.S. both to understand them better for intelligence purposes and to test them in combat situations.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Archives at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. And he made the Freedom of Information request to find out about Area 51 and has received the first declassified material with any real substance to it. Of course, I guess inquiring minds want to know about the hangar that has the aliens and the alien spacecraft.
Well, that's not in this history. There's the only discussion related to UFOs or anything like that is in this history is about how U-2 operations led to at least some of the UFO sightings, but you were flying an airplane at much higher levels than people expected, and so it was something that was quite unusual in the sky, and it was an unidentified flying object in the sense that it was flying and people didn't know what it was, so therefore it was unidentified. But if people are going to look for even oblique clues to anything concerning aliens or crash flying saucers in this history, that they won't find it.
Because I recall interviewing a L.A. Times reporter some time back, Annie Jacobson, who wrote a book, Area 51, an Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, that talked about some source had said that there was either it was a Soviet-built craft or a real alien. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to fire up the imaginations of people who listen to Art Bell at 3 in the morning. But apparently this mystique, these conspiracy theories have flourished. And so what's your explanation? Is it simply that this is such a secret place that the assumption was that this is where America keeps its most bizarre secrets, whether or not they're true or not?
In a sense, I think you have on the one hand the whole sort of history of this, of the UFO interest and beliefs that there were crash saucers and that we were being visited by people from or beings from other planets. And then you have this incredibly secret facility in a remote part of the country, protected both by the geography as well as very aggressive security arrangements. And so if you believed in crash saucers and aliens, presumably this was the natural place to put them. And so the two things went together. But if you don't believe in the first, then there's plenty of reasons to understand what's going on at Area 51 completely apart from aliens.
So it started then as a place to develop the U-2 so that the Soviets didn't know about its existence. Of course, they eventually found out when Francis Gary Powers crashed on May Day in 1960. But prior to that, the plane was incredibly secret. And it started out as a CIA project. Apparently, a personal check was sent to Lockheed to get the thing going from the CIA director, and they developed this program. And my understanding is, I'm trying to figure out here the turf battles that went on between the CIA and the intelligence community and the Air Force, who are also partners in this, because you mentioned the SR-71, the subsequent development of the U-2, which apparently was a very successful, extraordinarily successful airplane. My understanding is that the Air Force just killed that because they got sick of flying this plane, and the take-all went to the CIA. So give us a sense of the turf battles in spite of the fact that they managed to build these very advanced aircraft.
Well, with regard to the U-2, There was a point fairly early on where the Air Force tried to sort of take over the program, and that was resisted. And eventually, you had two programs going on. You had the CIA U-2 effort, which involved actual overflights of denied territory, whether first the Soviet Union and then China and other areas. And you had an Air Force version of the U-2 program, where they were doing peripheral flights along borders, doing nuclear sampling. And those two things coexisted until 1974, when the CIA program was shut down. By that time, there certainly were no overflights of the Soviet Union. The overflights over China had ceased, and there was a desire to sort of consolidate the U-2 in one area, and then it all went to the Air Force. With regard to the Oxcart, that didn't fly, although it was ready to fly years earlier, operationally until 1968. And by that time, there was also a battle between the Air Force and the CIA over the Oxcart versus the SR-71. And they actually had a competition called Nice Girl, in which each of the planes or several missions were conducted from north to south along the Mississippi using the capabilities of each different type of aircraft. And they compared the results, and there was no real conclusive winner. I mean, the Air Force plane had some different sensors than the CIA plane, although they both had optical equipment on board, cameras on board. And eventually it was decided to, after a very bitter battle, to terminate the A-12 program, which happened in 1968, and all those planes were retired and went into hangars, and the Air Force flew the SR-71 then from 1968 till around 1990 when it was retired. There were several attempts to bring it back, but those were pretty futile. And so the SR-71 was then killed by the Air Force, which had gone to such lengths to gain control of that type of program years earlier.
But
And today, the only thing that's sort of left standing or left flying are the U-2s flown by the Air Force.
Which are an earlier version. I mean, they're much older than the SR. Because I understood that at the time that the Air Force canceled the SR-71, a lot of generals were complaining about not having real-time pictures and stuff. I think it was maybe in the first Iraq War. And they wanted this plane, but it had been canceled by the Air Force for reasons which has never been made clear.
Well, I think that there were, concerns over the amount of resources it took up. I think there was probably just some hostility that it wasn't a plane with any guns on board. It wasn't a shooter. I think there were a multitude of reasons why. And as I said, there were a number of attempts to bring it back over the years for either counter-narcotics missions or other missions, and those never really took hold. And so it finally really did, really was terminated. But, I mean, the U-2s that fly today are much more advanced versions than the U-2s of 1960. They've been through a multitude of generations. And also, I think there was anticipation with regard to canceling the SR-71. There would be more advanced drones available. There were some programs that were canceled in that area that I think people were counting on as replacements.
But still, the predecessor that predated the SR-71 is the one that's still the workhorse.
The U-2, yes.
Yeah. And that's, I must have one of the longest shelf lives of any aircraft. I suppose there was an article the other day about the B-52s, which are still flying since,
right,
what, 1950 or something, when they first came on.
Yes, the U-2s are still flying. There have been a number of plans to cancel them over the years, and so far they're still flying because the proposed successors, whether it's other drones or Global Hawk, have always run into some sort of problem that have prevented them from completely taking over the mission.
And yeah, with one of them ending up in Iranian hands, which is still a mystery of how that happened.
Right. I think that was the RQ-170 Sentinel that that the Iranians got hold of.
And that still is a complete mystery as to how that happened.
Right.
So, well, just in closing then, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, will this information that you got out of the CIA about Area 51, will it put to rest, do you think, a lot of this speculation about aliens? Because when I tried to talk to the CIA years ago about UFOs and stuff, everybody said, oh, well, that's not our portfolio. That's the Air Force's portfolio.
Right.
I mean, that's been the line all along, hasn't it?
And, yeah. Well, I mean, this is a history that concerns the U2. And so I don't think people who believe that there are crash saucers or dead aliens at Area 51 are going to be I don't think their mind's going to be changed by that, because I don't think they believe that the U2 was just a cover for this stuff and that there was some other reason for maybe establishing the base. They just believe, I presume, that there are part of the bases involved with that activity, and I presume they'll still believe it. I mean, I think the only way you would, you know, put that to rest completely is if you had a complete and thorough history of Area 51, which accounted for everything that ever happened there and everything that was ever built there. And we're a long way from that. So I don't think it's really going to change people's position on that issue.
Well, but given how long it's taken, we're talking about an aircraft developed in the 50s and was flying in until the U-2 Francis Gary Powers was shot down in 1960 on May Day. That's when we first learned about it. So how long is that? That's what, 50?
3 years.
Yes. So so what are we going to find out about 53 years later about what's going on there now? That's my final question.
Oh, I presume we'll find out about a lot of advanced drones, some of which have been sort of written about but have never officially been declassified, maybe some attempts at other manned aerial reconnaissance planes, some other stealth aircraft experiments. I presume there'll be a lot to find out, but I guess, sort of we don't know what we don't know in terms of some of these aircraft missions or activities. So, but I think that's what we'll find out about is largely aerial projects, whether manned or unmanned, and none of them will be from another world.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Archive at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. He's taught at the University of Texas and at American University, and is the author of a number of books, including The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, America's Space Sentinels, DSP Satellites and National Security, The U.S. Intelligence Community, A Century of Spies, Intelligence in the 20th Century, and America's Secret Eyes in Space, the U.S. Keyhole Spy Satellite Program. His Freedom of Information Act led to the declassification of the latest cache on Area 51. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.